like, she'd said, but I'll always wear this one. She had hung it around her neck, liking the way it felt between her breasts, and now here was this unknown woman, this bitch, trying to take it off. Detta had come forward, struggling with Mia. Detta had had absolutely no success in trying to reassert control over Roland, but Mia was no Roland of Gilead. Mia's hands dropped away from the rawhide. Her control wavered. When it did, Susanna felt another of those labor pains sweep through her, making her double over and groan. "It has to come off," Mia shouted. "Otherwise they'll have his scent as well as yours. Your husband's. You don't want that, believe me."
"Who?" Susanna had asked. "Who are you talking about?"
"Never mind, there's no time, but if he comes after you, and I know you think he'll try, they mustn't have his scent. I'll leave it here, where he'll find it. Later, if Ka wills, you may wear it again."
Susanna had thought of telling her they could wash the ring off, wash Eddie's smell off it. But she knew it wasn't just a smell Mia was speaking of. It was a love ring, and that scent would always remain. But for whom? The wolves, she supposed, the real wolves, the ones in New York, the vampires of whom Callahan had spoken, and the low men. Or was there something else? Something even worse?
"Help me!"
Mia cried, and again Susanna found that cry impossible to resist. The baby might or might not be Mia's, and it might or might not be a monster, but her body wanted to have it. Her eyes wanted to see it, whatever it was, and her ears wanted to hear it cry, even if the cries were really snarls. She had taken the ring off, kissed it, and then dropped it at the foot of the path where Eddie would surely see it. Because he would follow her at least this far, she knew it. Then what? She didn't know. She thought she remembered riding on something most of the way up a steep path, surely the path which led to the doorway cave, then blackness. Not blackness. No, not complete blackness. There were blinking lights. The low glow of television screens that were, for the time being, projecting no pictures but only soft gray light. The faint hum of motors. The click of relays. This was the Dogan, Jake's Dogan, some sort of control room. Maybe a place she had constructed herself, maybe her imagination's version of a Quonset hut Jake had found on the west side of the River Wye. The next thing she remembered clearly was being back in New York. Her eyes were windows she looked through as Mia stole some poor terrified woman's shoes. Susanna came forward again, asking for help. She meant to go on, to tell the woman she needed to go to the hospital, needed a doctor, she was going to have a baby and something was wrong with it. Before she could get any of that out, another labor pain washed over her, this one monstrous, deeper than any pain she had ever felt in her life, worse even than the pain she'd felt after the loss of her lower legs. This, though, this... "Oh, Christ!" she said. But Mia took over again before she could say anything else, telling Susanna that she had to make it stop, and telling the woman that if she whistled for any John Laws, she'd lose a pair of something a lot more valuable to her than shoes. "Mia, listen to me," Susanna told her. "I can stop it again. I think I can, but you have to help. You have to sit down. If you don't settle for a while, God himself won't be able to stop your labor from running its course. Do you understand? Do you hear me?" Mia did. She stayed where she was for a moment, watching the woman from whom she'd stolen the shoes. Then, almost timidly, she asked a question. "Where should I go?" Susanna sensed that her kidnapper was for the first time becoming aware of the enormous city in which she now found herself, was finally seeing the surging schools of pedestrians, the floods of metal carriages, every third one, it seemed, painted a yellow so bright it almost screamed, and towers so high that on a cloudy day their tops would have been lost to view. Two women looked at an alien city through one set of eyes. Susanna knew it was her city, but in many ways it no longer was. She'd left New York in 1964. How many years further along was this, 20, 30? Never mind, let it go. Now was not the time to worry about it. Their combined gaze settled on the little pocket park across the street. The labor pains had ceased for the time being, and when the sign over there said walk, Trudy Damascus's black woman, who didn't look particularly pregnant, crossed, walking slowly but steadily. On the far side was a bench beside a fountain and a metal sculpture. Seeing the turtle comforted Susanna a little. It was as if Roland had left her this sign, what the gunslinger himself would have called a sigil. "He'll come after me, too," she told Mia. "And you should wear him, woman. You should wear him very well."
"I'll do what I need to do," Mia replied. "You want to see the woman's papers? Why?"
"I want to see when this is. The newspaper will say." Brown hands pulled the rolled-up newspaper from the canvas boarder's bag, unrolled it, and held it up to blue eyes that had started that day as brown as the hands. Susanna saw the date, June 1st, 1999, and marveled over it. Not 20 years or even 30, but 35. Until this moment, she hadn't realized how little she'd thought of the world's chances to survive so long. The contemporaries she'd known in her old life, fellow students, civil rights advocates, drinking buddies, and folk music aficionados, would now be edging into late middle age. Some were undoubtedly dead.
"Enough," Mia said, and tossed the newspaper back into the trash barrel, where it curled into its former rolled shape.
She brushed as much dirt as she could from the soles of her bare feet. Because of the dirt, Susanna did not notice they had changed color, and then put on the stolen shoes. They were a little tight, and with no socks, she supposed they'd give her blisters if she had to walk very far, but...
"What do you care, right?" Susanna asked her. "Ain't your feet?"
And knew as soon as she'd said it, for this was a form of talking, what Roland called palaver, that she might be wrong about that. Certainly her own feet, those which had marched obediently through life below the body of Odetta Holmes and sometimes Detta Walker, were long gone, rotting or, more likely, burned in some municipal incinerator. But she did not notice the change in color. Except later she'd think, "You noticed all right. Noticed it and blocked it right out. Because too much is too much." Before she could pursue the question, as much philosophical as it was physical, of whose feet she now wore, another labor pain struck her. It cramped her stomach and turned it to stone even as it loosened her thighs. For the first time she felt the dismaying and terrifying need to push.
"You have to stop it," Mia cried. "Woman, you have to, for the chap's sake and for ours, too."
"Yes, all right, but how?" "Close your eyes," Susanna told her.
"What? Didn't you hear me? You've got to..."
"I heard you," Susanna said. "Close your eyes." The park disappeared. The world went dark. She was a black woman, still young and undoubtedly beautiful, sitting on a park bench beside a fountain and a metal turtle with a wet and gleaming metal shell. She might have been meditating on this warm late spring afternoon in the year of 1999.
"I'm going away for a little while now," Susanna said. "I'll be back. In the meantime, sit where you are. Sit quiet. Don't move.
The pain should draw back again, but even if it doesn't at first, sit still. Moving around will only make it worse. Do you understand me?" Mia might be frightened, and she was certainly determined to have her way, but she wasn't dumb. She asked only a single question.
"Where are you going?"
"Back to the Dogen," Susanna said. "My Dogen. The one inside." 2. The building Jake had found on the far side of the River Wye was some sort of ancient communications and surveillance post. The boy had described it to them in some detail, but he still might not have recognized Susanna's imagined version of it, which was based on a technology which had been far out of date only 13 years later, when Jake had left New York for Midworld. In Susanna's win, Lyndon Johnson had been president and color TV was still a curiosity. Computers were huge things that filled whole buildings. Yet Susanna had visited the city of Ludd and seen some of the wonders there, and so Jake might have recognized the place where he had hidden from Ben Sleitman and Andy the Messenger Robot after all. Certainly he would have recognized the dusty linoleum floor with its checkerboard pattern of black and red squares and the rolling chairs along consoles filled with blinking lights and glowing dials. And he would have recognized the skeleton in the corner, grinning above the frayed collar of its ancient uniform shirt. She crossed the room and sat in one of the chairs. Above her, black and white TV screens showed dozens of pictures. Some were of Colubrin Sturgis, the town common, Callahan's church, the general store, the road leading east out of town. Some were still pictures like studio photographs. One of Roland, one of a smiling Jake holding Oi in his arms, and one, she could hardly bear to look at it, of Eddie, with his hat tipped back, cowpoke style, and his whittling knife in one hand. Another monitor showed the slim black woman sitting on the bench beside the turtle, knees together, hands folded in her lap, eyes closed, a pair of stolen shoes on her feet. She now had three bags, the one she'd stolen from the woman on Second Avenue, the rush sack with the sharpened arises in it, and a bowling bag. This one was a faded red, and there was something with square corners inside it, a box. Looking at it in the TV screen made Susanna feel angry, betrayed. But she didn't know why. The bag was pink on the other side, she thought. It changed color when we crossed, but only a little. The woman's face on the black and white screen above the control board grimaced. Susanna felt an echo of the pain Mia was experiencing, only faint and distant. Got to stop that, and quick. The question still remained. How? The way you did on the other side. While she was horsing her freight up to that cave just as fast as she damn could. But that seemed a long time ago now, in another life. And why not? It had been another life, another world. And if she ever hoped to get back there, she had to help right now. So what had she done? You used this stuff, that's what you did. It's only in your head, anyway. What Professor Overmeyer called a visualization technique back in Psych 1. Close your eyes. Susanna did so. Now both sets of eyes were closed, the physical ones that Mia controlled in New York and the ones in her mind. Visualize. She did. Or tried. Open. She opened her eyes. Now, on the panel in front of her, there were two large dials and a single toggle switch where before there had been rheostats and flashing lights. The dials looked to be made of Bakelite, like the oven dials on her mother's stove back in the house where Susanna had grown up. She supposed there was no surprise there. All you imagined, no matter how wild it might seem, was no more than a disguised version of what you already knew. The dial on her left was labeled Emotional Temp. The markings on it ran from 32 to 212, 32 in blue, 212 in bright red. It was currently set at 160. The dial in the middle was marked Labor Force. The numbers around its face went from 0 to 10, and it was currently turned to 9. The label under the toggle switch simply read CHAP, and there were only two settings, awake and asleep. It was currently set to awake. Susanna looked up and saw one of the screens was now showing a baby in utero. It was a boy. A beautiful boy. His tiny penis floated like a strand of kelp below the lazy curl of his umbilical cord. His eyes were open, and although the rest of the image was black and white, those eyes were a piercing blue. The chap's gaze seemed to go right through her. They're Roland's eyes, she thought, feeling stupid with wonder. How can that be? It couldn't, of course. All this was nothing but the work of her own imagination, a visualization technique. But if so, why would she imagine Roland's blue eyes? Why not Eddie's hazel ones? Why not her husband's hazel eyes? No time for that now. Do what you have to do. She reached out to Emotional Temp with her lower lip caught between her teeth, on a monitor showing the park bench. Mia also began biting her lower lip. She hesitated, then dialed it back to 72, exactly as if it was a thermostat,
And wasn't it? Calm immediately filled her. She relaxed in her chair and let her lip escape the grip of her teeth. On the park monitor, the black woman did the same. All right. So far, so good. She hesitated for a moment with her hand not quite touching the labor force dial, then moved on to chap instead. She flipped the toggle from awake to asleep. The baby's eyes closed immediately. Susanna found this something of a relief. Those blue eyes were disconcerting. All right, back to labor force. Susanna thought this was the important one, what Eddie would call the big casino. She took hold of the old-fashioned dial, applied a little experimental force, and was not exactly surprised to find the clunky thing dully resistant in its socket. It didn't want to turn. But you will, Susanna thought, because we need you to. We need you to. She grasped it tightly and began turning it slowly counterclockwise. A pain went through her head and she grimaced. Another momentarily constricted her throat as if she'd gotten a fishbone stuck in there, but then both pains cleared. To her right, an entire bank of lights flashed on, most of them amber, a few bright red.
"Warning,"
said a voice that sounded eerily like that of Blaine the Mono. "This operation may exceed safety parameters." No shit, Sherlock, Susanna thought. The labor force dial was now down to 6. When she turned it past 5, another bank of amber and red lights flashed on, and 3 of the monitors showing Kala scenes shorted out with sizzling pops. Another pain gripped her head like invisible pressing fingers. From somewhere beneath her came the start-up whine of motors or turbines. Big ones from the sound. She could feel them thrumming against her feet, which were bare, of course. Mia had gotten the shoes. Oh, well, she thought, I didn't have any feet at all before this, so maybe I'm ahead of the game.
Warning, said the mechanical voice. What you're doing is dangerous, Susanna of New York. Hear me, I beg. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
One of Roland's proverbs occurred to her. You do what you need to, and I'll do what I need to, and we'll see who gets the goose. She wasn't sure what it meant, but it seemed to fit the situation, so she repeated it aloud as she slowly but steadily turned the labor force dial past 4 to 3. She meant to turn the dial all the way back to 1, but the pain which ripped through her head when the absurd thing passed 2 was so huge, so sickening, that she dropped her hand. For a moment the pain continued, intensified even, and she thought it would kill her. Mia would topple off the bench where she was sitting, and both of them would be dead before their shared body hit the concrete in front of the turtle sculpture. Tomorrow or the next day, her remains would take a quick trip to Potter's Field. And what would go on the death certificate? Stroke? Heart attack? Or maybe that old standby of the medical man in a hurry, natural causes? But the pain subsided, and she was still alive when it did. She sat in front of the console with the 2 ridiculous dials and the toggle switch, taking deep breaths and wiping the sweat from her cheeks with both hands. Boy howdy, when it came to visualization technique, she had to be the champ of the world. This is more than visualization. You know that, right? She supposed she did. Something had changed her, had changed all of them. Jake had gotten the touch, which was a kind of telepathy. Eddie had grown, was still growing, into some sort of ability to create powerful, talismanic objects. One of them had already served to open a door between 2 worlds. And she? I see. That's all, except if I see it hard enough, it starts to be real. The way Detta Walker got to be real. All over this version of the Dogon, amber lights were glowing. Even as she looked, some turned red. Beneath her feet, special guest feet, she thought them. The floor trembled and thrummed. Enough of this, and cracks would start to appear in its elderly surface. Cracks that would widen and deepen. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the House of Usher. Susanna got up from the chair and looked around. She should go back. Was there anything else that needed doing before she did? One thing occurred to her. 3. Susanna closed her eyes and imagined a radio mic. When she opened them, the mic was there, standing on the console to the right of the two dials and the toggle switch. She had imagined a Zenith trademark, right down to the lightning bolt Z on the microphone's base, but North Central Positronics had been stamped there instead. So something was messing in with her visualization technique. She found that extremely scary. On the control panel, directly behind the microphone, was a semicircular, tricolored readout with the words Susanna Mio printed below it. A needle was moving out of the green and into the yellow. Beyond the yellow segment, the dial turned red, and a single word was printed in black. Danger. Susanna picked up the mic, saw no way to use it, closed her eyes again, and imagined a toggle switch like the one marked with awake and asleep, only this time on the side of the mic. When she opened her eyes again, the switch was there. She pressed it. "Eddie," she said. She felt a little foolish, but went on anyway. "Eddie, if you hear me, I'm okay, at least for the time being. I'm with Mia in New York. It's June 1st of 1999, and I'm going to try and help her have the baby. I don't see any other choice. If nothing else, I have to be rid of it myself. Eddie, you take care of yourself. I..." Her eyes welled with tears. "I love you, sugar. So much." The tears spilled down her cheeks. She started to wipe them away and then stopped herself. Didn't she have a right to cry for her man? As much right as any other woman? She waited for a response, knowing she could make one if she wanted to and resisting the urge. This wasn't a situation where talking to herself in Eddie's voice would do any good. Suddenly her vision doubled in front of her eyes. She saw the Dogon for the unreal shade that it was. Beyond its walls were not the deserty wastelands on the east side of the Y, but Second Avenue with its rushing traffic. Mia had opened her eyes. She was feeling fine again, thanks to me, Honey Bunch, thanks to me, and was ready to move on. Susanna went back. 4. A black woman, who still thought of herself as a Negro woman, was sitting on a bench in New York City in the spring of 99. A black woman with her traveling bags, her gunna, spread around her. One of them was a faded red. "Nothing but strikes at Midtown Lanes" was printed on it. It had been pink on the other side, the color of the rose. Mia stood up. Susanna promptly came forward and made her sit down again. "What did you do that for?" Mia asked, surprised. "I don't know. I don't have a clue. But let's us palaver a little. Why don't you start by telling me where you want to go?"
"I need a telephone. Someone'll call."
"Telephone," Susanna said. "And by the way, there's blood on our shirt, sugar. Margaret Eisenhart's blood, and sooner or later, someone's going to recognize it for what it is. Then where will you be?" The response to this was wordless, a swell of smiling contempt. It made Susanna angry. 5 minutes ago, or maybe 15, it was hard to keep track of time when you were having fun, this hijacking bitch had been screaming for help. And now that she'd gotten it, what her rescuer got was an internal contemptuous smile. What made it worse was that the bitch was right. She could probably stroll around Midtown all day without anyone asking her if that was dried blood on her shirt or had she maybe just spilled her chocolate egg cream. "All right," she said, "but even if nobody bothers you about the blood, where are you going to store your goods?" Then another question occurred to her, one that probably should have come to her right away. "Mia, how do you even know what a telephone is? And don't tell me they have him where you came from, either." No response. Only a kind of watchful silence. But she had wiped the smile off the bitch's face. She'd done that much. "You have friends, don't you? Or at least you think they're friends, folks you've been talking to behind my back. Folks that'll help you, or so you think. Are you going to help me or not?" Back to that. And angry, but beneath the anger, what, fright? Probably that was too strong, at least for now, but worry, certainly. "How long have we got before the labor starts up again?"
Susanna guessed somewhere between 6 and 10 hours, certainly before midnight saw in June 2nd, but tried to keep this to herself.
I don't know. Not all that long.
Then we have to get started. I have to find a phone, in a private place.
Susanna thought there was a hotel at the First Avenue end of 46th Street, and tried to keep this to herself. Her eyes went back to the bag, once pink, now red, and suddenly she understood. Not everything, but enough to dismay and anger her.
"I'll leave it here," Mia had said, speaking of the ring Eddie had made her. "I'll leave it here where he'll find it. Later, if Ka wills, you may wear it again."
Not a promise exactly, at least not a direct one. But Mia had certainly implied. Dull anger surged through Susanna's mind. No, she'd not promised. She had simply led Susanna in a certain direction, and Susanna had done the rest.
"She didn't cousin me. She let me cousin myself."
Mia stood up again, and once again Susanna came forward and made her sit down, hard this time.
"What? Susanna, you promised. The chap—"
"I'll help you with the chap," Susanna replied grimly.
She bent forward and picked up the red bag, the bag with the box inside it. And inside the box? The ghostwood box, with "unfound" written upon it in runes? She could feel a baleful pulse even through the layer of magical wood and cloth which hid it. Black 13 was in the bag. Mia had taken it through the door, and if it was the ball that opened the door, how could Eddie get to her now?
"I did what I had to," Mia said nervously. "It's my baby, my chap. And every hand is against me now, every hand but yours. And you only help me because you have to. Remember what I said, 'If Ka wills,' I said."
It was Detta Walker's voice that replied. It was harsh and crude and brooked no argument.
"I don't give a shit about Ka," she said. "And you best be remembering that. You got problems, girl. Got a rug monkey coming. You don't know what it is. Got folks say they help you, and you don't know what they are. Shit, you don't even know what a telephone is or where to find one. Now we gonna sit here, and you gonna tell me what happens next. We gonna palaver, girl, and if you don't play straight, we still be sitting here with these baggers come nightfall, and you can have your precious chap on this bench and wash him off in a fucking fountain."
The woman on the bench bared her teeth in a gruesome smile that was all Detta Walker.
"You care about that chap, and Susanna, she care a little about that chap, but I've been mostly turned out of this body, and I don't give a shit."
A woman pushing a stroller, it looked as divinely lightweight as Susanna's abandoned wheelchair, gave the woman on the bench a nervous glance and then pushed her own baby onward so fast she was nearly running.
"So," Detta said brightly, "it's be pretty out here, don't you think? Good weather for talking. You hear me, Mama?"
No reply from Mia, daughter of none and mother of one. Detta wasn't put out of countenance. Her grin widened.
"You hear me all right. You hear me just fine. So let's us have a little chat. Let's us palaver."
Stave. "Kamala, come, Co. What you doing at my door? If you don't tell me now, my friend, I'll lay you on the floor."
Response.
"Kamala, come, foe. I can lay you low. The things I've done to such as you, you never want to know."
Fifth stanza. The Turtle. 1. Mia said,
"Talking will be easier, quicker and clearer, too, if we do it face to face."
"How can we?" Susanna asked.
"We'll have our palaver in the castle," Mia replied promptly. "The castle on the abyss, in the banquet room. Do you remember the banquet room?"
Susanna nodded, but hesitantly. Her memories of the banquet room were but recently recovered, and consequently vague. She wasn't sorry, either. Mia's feeding there had been, well, enthusiastic, to say the very least. She'd eaten from many plates, mostly with her fingers, and drunk from many glasses, and spoken to many phantoms in many borrowed voices. Borrowed, hell, stolen voices. Two of these Susanna had known quite well. One had been Odetta Holmes's nervous and rather hoity-toity social voice. Another had been Detta's raucous, who-gives-a-shit bellow. Mia's thievery had extended to every aspect of Susanna's personality, it seemed. And if Detta Walker was back, pumped up and ready to cut butt, That was in large part this unwelcome stranger's doing.
The gunslinger saw me there, Mia said. The boy, too.
There was a pause, then...
I have met them both before.
Who? Jake and Roland?
I, they.
Where?
When? How could you... We can't speak here. Please, let us go somewhere more private.
Someplace with a phone, isn't that what you mean? So your friends can call you?
I only know a little, Susanna, of New York, but what little I know, I think you would hear.
Susanna thought so, too. And although she didn't necessarily want Mia to realize it, she was also anxious to get off Second Avenue. The stuff on her shirt might look like spilled egg cream or dried coffee to the casual passerby, but Susanna herself was acutely aware of what it was. Not just blood, but the blood of a brave woman who had stood true on behalf of her town's children. And there were the bags spread around her feet. She'd seen plenty of bag folk in New York. Aye, now she felt like one herself. And she didn't like the feeling. She'd been raised to better, as her mother would have said. Each time someone passing on the sidewalk or cutting through the little park gave her a glance, she felt like telling them she wasn't crazy in spite of how she looked. Stained shirt, dirty face, hair too long and in disarray, no purse, only those three bags at her feet. Homeless, aye, had anyone ever been as homeless as she, not just out of house, but out of time itself, but in her right mind. She needed to palaver with Mia and get an understanding of what all this was about, that was true. What she wanted was much simpler. To wash, to put on fresh clothes, and to be out of public view for at least a little while.
Might as well wish for the moon, sugar, she told herself. And Mia... If Mia was listening. Privacy costs money. You're in a version of New York where a single hamburger might cost as much as a dollar, crazy as that sounds. And you don't have a sou. Just a dozen or so sharpened plates and some kind of black magic ball. So what are you going to do?
Before she could get any further in her thinking, New York was swept away, and she was back in the doorway cave. She'd been barely aware of her surroundings on her first visit. Mia had been in charge then, and in a hurry to make her getaway through the door, but now they were very clear. Per Callahan was here. So was Eddie. And Eddie's brother, in a way. Susanna could hear Henry Dean's voice floating up from the cave's depths, both taunting and dismayed.
I'm in hell, bro. I'm in hell, and I can't get a fix. And it's all your fault.
Susanna's disorientation was nothing to the fury she felt at the sound of that nagging, hectoring voice.
"Most of what was wrong with Eddie was your fault," she screamed at him. "You should have done everyone a favor and died young, Henry."
Those in the cave didn't even look around at her. What was this? Had she come here toe-dash from New York just to add to the fun? If so, why hadn't she heard the chimes?
"Hush, hush, love."
That was Eddie's voice in her mind, clear as day. Just watch.
Do you hear him? She asked Mia. Do you? Yes, now shut up.
How long will we have to be here, do you think?
Eddie asked Callahan.
I'm afraid it'll be a while, Callahan replied.
And Susanna understood. She was seeing something that had already happened. Eddie and Callahan had gone up to the doorway cave to try to locate Calvin Tower and Tower's friend, Deepno. Just before the showdown with the wolves, this had been. Callahan was the one who'd gone through the door. Black 13 had captured Eddie while the pair was gone, and almost killed him. Callahan had returned just in time to keep Eddie from hurling himself from the top of the bluff and into the draw far below. Right now, though, Eddie was dragging the bag, pink, yes, she'd been right about that, on the collar side it had been pink, out from underneath the troublesome Cy Towers bookcase of first editions. They needed the ball inside the bag for the same reason Mia had needed it, because it opened the unfound door. Eddie lifted it, started to turn, then froze. He was frowning.
What is it? Callahan asked.
There's something in here, Eddie replied.
The box.
No, in the bag. Sewn into the lining, it feels like a little rock or something.
Suddenly he seemed to be looking directly at Susanna, and she was aware that she was sitting on a park bench. It was no longer voices from the depths of the cave she heard, but the watery hiss and plash of the fountain. The cave was fading. Eddie and Callahan were fading. She heard Eddie's last words as if from a great distance. "Maybe there's a secret pocket." Then he was gone. 2. She hadn't gone toe-dash at all then. Her brief visit to the doorway cave had been some kind of vision. Had Eddie sent it to her? And if he had, did it mean he'd gotten the message she'd tried to send him from the Dogon? These were questions Susanna couldn't answer. If she saw him again, she'd ask him. After she'd kissed him 1,000 times or so, that was. Mia picked up the red bag and ran her hand slowly down its sides. There was the shape of the box inside, yes, but halfway down there was something else, a small bulge. And Eddie was right, it felt like a stone. She, or perhaps it was they, it no longer mattered to her, rolled the bag down, not liking the intensified pulse from the thing hidden inside, but setting her mind against it. Here it was, right in here, and something that felt like a seam. She leaned closer and saw not a seam, but some kind of a seal. She didn't recognize it, nor would Jake have done, but Eddie would have known Velcro when he saw it. She had heard a certain ZZ Top tribute to the stuff, a song called Velcro Fly. She got a fingernail into the seal and pulled with her fingertip. It came loose with a soft ripping sound, revealing a small pocket on the inside of the bag. "What is it?" Mia asked, fascinated in spite of herself. "Well, let's just see." She reached in and brought out not a stone, but a small scrimshaw turtle, made of ivory from the look of it. Each detail of the shell was tiny and precisely executed, although it had been marred by one tiny scratch that looked almost like a question mark. The turtle's head poked halfway out. Its eyes were tiny black dots of some tarry stuff and looked incredibly alive. She saw another small imperfection in the turtle's beak. Not a scratch, but a crack. "It's old," she whispered aloud. "So old." "Yes," Mia whispered back. Holding it made Susanna feel incredibly good. It made her feel safe somehow. "See the turtle," she thought. "See the turtle of enormous girth. On his shell he holds the earth." Was that how it went? She thought it was at least close, and of course that was the beam they had been following to the tower. The bear at one end, Shardik, the turtle at the other, Maturin. She looked from the tiny totem she'd found in the lining of the bag to the one beside the fountain. Barring the difference in materials, the one beside her bench was made of dark metal with brighter coppery glints. They were exactly the same. Right down to the scratch on the shell and the tiny wedge-shaped break in the beak. For a moment her breath stopped, and her heart seemed to stop also. She went along from moment to moment through this adventure, sometimes even from day to day, without thinking much but simply driven by events and what Roland insisted was Ka. Then something like this would happen, and she would for a moment glimpse a far bigger picture, one that immobilized her with awe and wonder. She sensed forces beyond her ability to comprehend. Some, like the ball in the Ghostwood box, were evil. But this... "Wow," someone said, almost sighed. She looked up and saw a businessman, a very successful one from the look of his suit, standing there by the bench. He'd been cutting through the park, probably on his way to some place as important as he was, some sort of meeting or a conference. Maybe even at the United Nations, which was close by, unless that had changed too. Now, however, he had come to a dead stop. His expensive briefcase dangled from his right hand. His eyes were large and fixed on the turtle in Susanna Mia's hand. On his face was a large and rather dopey grin. "Put it away," Mia cried, alarmed. "He'll steal it." "Like to see him try," Detta Walker replied. Her voice was relaxed and rather amused. The sun was out, and she, all parts of she, suddenly realized that, all else aside, this day was beautiful, and precious, and gorgeous.
"Precious and beautiful and gorgeous," said the businessman, or perhaps he was a diplomat, who had forgotten all about his business.
Was it the day he was talking about, or the scrimshaw turtle?
"It's both," Susanna thought,
and suddenly she thought she understood this. Jake would have understood, too, no one better. She laughed. Inside her, Detta and Mia also laughed, Mia a bit against her will. And the businessman, or diplomat, he laughed, too.
"Ja, it's Bord," the businessman said.
In his faint Scandinavian accent, both came out Bord.
"What a lovely thing you have."
Yes, it was lovely, a lovely little treasure. And once upon a time, not so long ago, Jake Chambers had found something queerly similar. In Calvin Towers' bookshop, Jake had bought a book called Charlie the Choo-Choo by Beryl Evans. Why? Because it had called to him. Later, shortly before Roland's Quartet had come to Calabrin Sturgis, in fact, the author's name had changed to Claudia E. Inez Bachmann, making her a member of the ever-expanding Quartet of 19. Jake had slipped a key into that book, and Eddie had whittled a double of it in Midworld. Jake's version of the key had both fascinated the folks who saw it and made them extremely suggestible. Like Jake's key, the scrimshaw turtle had its double. She was sitting beside it. The question was if the turtle was like Jake's key, in other ways. Judging from the fascinated way the Scandinavian businessman was looking at it, Susanna was pretty sure the answer was yes. She thought, "Dada Chuck, Dada Turtle, don't worry, girl, you got the turtle." It was such a silly rhyme, she almost laughed out loud. To Mia, she said, "Let me handle this."
"Handle what? I don't understand."
"I know you don't, so let me handle it, agreed?" She didn't wait for Mia's reply. She turned back to the businessman, smiling brightly, holding the turtle up where he could see it. She floated it from right to left, and noted the way his eyes followed it, although his head, with its impressive mane of white hair, never moved.
"What's your name, Si?"
Susanna asked.
"Matthiasen van Wyk," he said.
His eyes rolled slowly in their sockets, watching the turtle.
"I am second assistant to the Swedish ambassador to the United Nations. My wife has taken a lover. This makes me sad. My bowels are regular once again. The tea the Hotel Masseuse recommended worked for me, and this makes me happy."
A pause. Then, "Your Sholpada makes me happy." Susanna was fascinated. If she asked this man to drop his trousers and evacuate his newly regularized bowels on the sidewalk, would he do it? Of course he would. She looked around quickly and saw no one in the immediate vicinity. That was good, but she thought it would still behoove her to transact her business here as quickly as she could. Jake had drawn quite the little crowd with his key. She had no urge to do the same if she could avoid it.
"Matthiasen," she began. "You mentioned Mats," he said.
"Beg your pardon?"
"Call me Mats, if you would. I prefer it."
"All right, Mats, you mentioned, do you speak Swedish?"
"No," she said.
"Then we will speak English."
"Yes, I'd prefer.
I have quite an important position," Mats said. His eyes never left the turtle.
"I am meeting many important peoples. I am going to cocktail parties where good-looking women are wearing the little black dress."
"That must be quite a thrill for you."
"Mats, I want you to shut your trap, and only open it to speak when I ask you a direct question. Will you do that?"
Mats closed his mouth. He even made a comical little zipping gesture across his lips, but his eyes never left the turtle.
"You mentioned a hotel. Do you stay at a hotel?"
"Ja, I am staying at the New York Plaza Park Hyatt at the corner of 1st and 46th. Soon I am getting the condominium apartment."
Mats seemed to realize he was saying too much again, and shut his mouth. Susanna thought furiously, holding the turtle in front of her breasts, where her new friend could see it very well.
"Mats, listen to me, okay? I listen to hear, Mistress Sai, and hear to obey."
That gave her a nasty jolt, especially coming out as it did in Matt's cute little Scandihoovian accent.
Do you have a credit card?
Matt smiled proudly. I have many. I have American Express, MasterCard, and Visa. I have the Euro Gold card. I have...
Good. That's good. I want you to go down to the... For a moment, her mind blanked, and then it came. To the Plaza Park Hotel, and rent a room. Rent it for a week. If they ask, tell them it's for a friend of yours, a lady friend. An unpleasant possibility occurred to her. This was New York, the North, in the year 1999, and a person liked to believe that things continued to go in the right direction, but it was best to be sure.
Will they make any unpleasantness about me being a Negro?
No, of course not.
He looked surprised. Rent the room in your name, and tell the clerk that a woman named Susanna Mia Dean will be using it. Do you understand?
Ja, Susanna Mia Dean.
What else? Money, of course. She asked him if he had any. Her new friend removed his wallet and handed it to her. She continued to hold the turtle where he could see it in one hand while she riffled through the wallet, a very nice Lord Buxton, with the other. There was a wad of traveler's checks, no good to her, not with that insanely convoluted signature, and about $200 in good old American cabbage. She took it and dropped it into the boarder's bag, which had lately held the pair of shoes. When she looked up, she was dismayed to see that a couple of Girl Scouts, maybe 14 years old and both wearing backpacks, had joined the businessman. They were staring at the turtle with shiny eyes and wet lips. Susanna found herself remembering the girls in the audience on the night Elvis Presley had played the Ed Sullivan Show.
"Too cool," one of them said, almost in a sigh.
"Totally awesome," said the other.
"You girls go on about your business," Susanna said. Their faces tucked in, assuming identical looks of sorrow. They could almost have been twins from the collar.
"Do we have to?"
asked the first.
"Yes,"
Susanna said.
"Thank ye, Si, long days and pleasant nights," said the second.
Tears had begun to roll down her cheeks. Her friend was also crying.
"Forget you saw me,"
Susanna called as they started away. She watched them nervously until they reached Second Avenue and headed uptown, then turned her attention back to Mats Van Wyck.
"You get a wiggle on too, Mats. Hoss your freight down to that hotel and rent a room. Tell them your friend Susanna will be right along."
"What is this freight hossing? I do not understand. It means hurry up."
She handed back his wallet, minus the cash, wishing she could have gotten a longer look at all those plastic cards, wondering why anyone would need so many.
"Once you have the room nailed down, go on to where you were going. Forget you ever saw me."
Now, like the girls in their green uniforms, Mats began to weep.
"Must I also forget the Sholpada?"
"Yes." Susanna remembered a hypnotist she'd once seen performing on some TV variety show, maybe even Ed Sullivan.
"No turtle, but you're going to feel good the rest of the day, you hear me? You're going to feel like..."
$1 million might not mean that much to him, and for all she knew, 1 million kroner wouldn't buy a haircut.
"You're going to feel like the Swedish ambassador himself, and you'll stop worrying about your wife's fancy man. To hell with him, right?"
"Yeah. To hell with that guy,"
Mats cried, and although he was still weeping, he was now smiling, too. There was something divinely childish in that smile. It made Susanna feel happy and sad at the same time. She wanted to do something else for Mats Van Wyck, if she could.
"And your bowels?"
"Ja."
"Like clockwork, for the rest of your life," Susanna said, holding the turtle up. "What's your usual time, Mats?"
"I am going just after breakfast."
"Then that's when it'll be. For the rest of your life. Unless you're busy. If you're late for an appointment or something like that, just say, Maturin, and the urge'll pass until the next day."
"Maturin."
"Correct. Go on now."
"May I not take the Sholpada?"
"No, you may not. Go on now."
He started away, then paused and looked back at her. Although his cheeks were wet, His expression was pixie-ish, a trifle sly.
"Perhaps I should take it," he said. "Perhaps it is mine by right. Like to see you try, honky,"
was Detta's thought, but Susanna, who felt more and more in charge of this wacky triad, at least for the time being, shushed her.
"Why would you say that, my friend? Tell, I beg."
The sly look remained. "Don't kid a kidder," it said. That was what it looked like to Susanna, anyway.
"Mats, Maturin," he said. "Maturin, Mats, you see?"
Susanna did. She started to tell him it was just a coincidence and then thought, "Kala Callahan."
"I see," she said, "but the Sholpada isn't yours, nor mine either."
"Then whose?"
"Plaintive."
And before her conscious mind could stop her, or at least censor her, Susanna spoke the truth her heart and soul knew.
"It belongs to the tower, Sai, the Dark Tower. And it's to there I'll return it, Ka willing."
"Gods be with you, Lady Sai. And you, Mats. Long days and pleasant nights." She watched the Swedish diplomat walk away, then looked down at the scrimshaw turtle and said, "That was pretty amazing, Mats, old buddy."
Mia had no interest in the turtle. She had but a single object.
"This hotel," she said. "Will there be a telephone?"
3. Susanna Mia put the turtle into the pocket of her blue jeans and forced herself to wait for 20 minutes on the park bench. She spent much of this time admiring her new lower legs, whoever they belonged to, they were pretty fine, and wiggling her new toes inside her new, stolen, shoes. Once she closed her eyes and summoned up the control room of the Dogon. More banks of warning lights had gone on there, and the machinery under the floor was throbbing louder than ever, but the needle of the dial marked Susanna Mio was still just a little way into the yellow. Cracks in the floor had begun to appear, as she had known they would, but so far they didn't look serious. The situation wasn't that great, but she thought they could live with it for now.
"What are you waiting for?" Mia demanded. "Why are we just sitting here?"
"I'm giving the Swede a chance to do his business for us at the hotel and clear out," Susanna replied. And when she thought enough time had passed for him to have done that, she gathered her bags, got up, crossed Second Avenue, and started down 46th Street to the Plaza Park Hotel. 4. The lobby was full of pleasant afternoon light, reflected by angles of green glass. Susanna had never seen such a beautiful room outside of St. Patrick's, that was, but there was something alien about it, too.
"Because it's the future," she thought.
God knew there were enough signs of that. The cars looked smaller and entirely different. Many of the younger women she saw were walking around with their lower bellies exposed and their bra straps showing. Susanna had to see this latter phenomenon 4 or 5 times on her stroll down 46th Street before she could completely convince herself that it was some sort of bizarre fashion, Philip, and not a mistake. In her day, a woman with a bra strap showing, or an inch of slip snowing down south, they used to say, would have ducked into the nearest public restroom to pin it up, and at once. As for the deal with the nude bellies, would have gotten you arrested anywhere but Coney Island, she thought. No doubt about it. But the thing which made the biggest impression was also the hardest thing to define. The city just seemed bigger. It thundered and hummed all around her. It vibrated. Every breath of air was perfumed with its signature smell. The women waiting for taxis outside the hotel, with or without their bra straps showing, could only be New York women. The doormen, not one, but two, flagging cabs could only be New York doormen. The cabbies, she was amazed by how many of them were dark-skinned, and she saw one who was wearing a turban, could only be New York cabbies. But they were all different. The world had moved on. It was as if her New York, that of 1964, had been a triple-A ball club. This was the major leagues. She paused for a moment just inside the lobby, pulling the scrimshaw turtle out of her pocket and getting her bearings. To her left was a parlor area. Two women were sitting there, chatting, and Susanna stared at them for a moment, hardly able to credit how much leg they were showing under the hems of their skirts. What skirts, ha-ha! And they weren't teenagers or college cuties, either. These were women in their 30s, at least, although she supposed they might be in their 60s. Who knew what scientific advances there might have been over the last 35 years? To the right was a little shop. Somewhere in the shadows behind it, a piano was tinkling out something blessedly familiar, night and day. And Susanna knew if she went toward the sound, she'd find a lot of leather seats, a lot of sparkling bottles, and a gentleman in a white coat who'd be happy to serve her, even if it was only the middle of the afternoon. All this was a decided relief. Directly ahead of her was the reception desk, and behind it was the most exotic woman Susanna had ever seen in her life. She appeared to be white, black, and Chinese, all whipped together. In 1964, such a woman would undoubtedly have been called a mongrel, no matter how beautiful she might have been. Here she'd been popped into an extremely handsome lady's suit and put behind the reception desk of a large first-class hotel. The Dark Tower might be increasingly shaky, Susanna thought, and the world might be moving on. But she thought the lovely desk clerk was proof, if any were needed, that not everything was falling down or going in the wrong direction. She was talking to a customer who was complaining about his in-room movie bill, whatever that might be. Never mind, it's the future, Susanna told herself once again. It's science fiction, like the City of Lud. Best leave it at that. I don't care what it is or when, Mia said. I want to be near a telephone. I want to see to my chap. Susanna walked past a sign on a tripod, then turned back and gave it a closer look.
As of July 1st, 1999, the New York Plaza Park Hyatt will become the Regal UN Plaza Hotel, another great Sombra North Central project.
Susanna thought, Sombra, as in Turtle Bay luxury condominiums, which never got built from the look of that black glass needle back on the corner. And North Central, as in North Central Positronics. Interesting. She felt a sudden twinge of pain go through her head. Twinge? Hell, a bolt. It made her eyes water, and she knew who had sent it. Mia, who had no interest in the Sombra Corporation, North Central Positronics, or the Dark Tower itself, was becoming impatient. Susanna knew she'd have to change that, or at least try. Mia was focused blindly on her chap, but if she wanted to keep the chap, she might have to widen her field of vision a little bit.
She fights you every damn step of the way,
Detta said. Her voice was shrewd and tough and cheerful.
You know that too, don't you?
She did. Susanna waited until the man with the problem finished explaining how he had ordered some movie called X-Rated by accident, and he didn't mind paying as long as it wasn't on his bill. And then she stepped up to the desk herself. Her heart was pounding. I believe that my friend, Matthiasen Van Wyck, has rented a room for me, she said. She saw the reception clerk looking at her stained shirt with well-bred disapproval and laughed nervously. I really can't wait to take a shower and change my clothes. I had a small accident at lunch.
Yes, madam, just let me check.
The woman went to what looked like a small TV screen with a typewriter attached. She tapped a few keys, looked at the screen, and then said, Susanna Mia Dean, is that correct?
You say true, I say thank you, rose to her lips, and she squelched it.
Yes, that's right.
May I see some identification, please?
For a moment, Susanna was flummoxed. Then she reached into the rush bag and took out an Oriza, being careful to hold it by the blunt curve. She found herself remembering something Roland had said to Wayne Overholzer, the Kala's big rancher. We deal in lead. The risers weren't bullets, but surely they were the equivalent. She held the plate up in one hand, and the small, carved turtle in the other.
Will this do? She asked pleasantly.
What? The beautiful desk clerk began, then fell silent as her eyes shifted from the plate to the turtle. They grew wide and slightly glassy. Her lips, coated with an interesting pink gloss, It looked more like candy than lipstick to Susanna, parted. A soft sound came from between them.
Oh.
It's my driver's license, Susanna said.
Do you see?
Luckily, there was no one else around, not even a bellman. The late-day checkouts were on the sidewalk, fighting for hacks